Okay. Thank you, everybody, for coming.
Just to put this out, I think.
Okay. Thank you, everybody, for coming. What we're going to do today is take a topic that spans really several centuries and includes quite a few stages. And we're going to give a synopsis of really what I think is the first half, what the scholarly literature it really depicts as the first half of this really long, several hundred year story called Maimonidean Controversy. We've at this stage in the world of halachic Judaism, that's the microphone? Okay. At this stage of halachic Judaism, we've arrived at a state in which the Rambam is actually universally accepted. We take it for granted, and to be honest with you, the more you study some of the more far out there things in the Rambam, the more, you know, when at least this was the case for me when I was in yeshiva, the more that it was strange to me that this stuff was not a subject of more controversy because of, I guess, the party line that I was fed in certain issues of Jewish philosophy over the years were really not along these lines. Never mind the fact that the Rambam, as we all know, that the Rambam was a celebrated physician, very involved politically. That the Rambam was also of course, as he is internationally renowned for, as a masterful philosopher, a staunch advocate of Aristotelian philosophy. And not only that, but thought that it was part and parcel of what a proper Jew needed in order to properly conceive of what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is. The fact that all of this is part of the Rambam's ideology makes the fact that he was, at this today, pretty much universally accepted, something somewhat strange, considering the fact that these are all principles that such a large swath of halachic Judaism today and its leadership so much vehemently rejects. Despite that, all right, what has kind of developed in the last couple centuries, at least certainly in my experience, but not only in my experience, also in from my exposure to the literature, to the contemporary halachic literature, stemming from various camps of the observant community, is really like there's this bifurcated kind of perception where the Rambam is ignored. A large section of who the Rambam was and what he believed in isn't really paid much attention to. And they see the Rambam as this master of halacha and even the master of an understanding of Jewish thought, and we basically ignore so much of what in his time and in centuries following him was so controversial. With that as the introduction in terms of our contemporary times, I want to jump into what exactly I'm talking about. In the Rambam's time, like I said, we take it for granted that the Rambam is an accepted figure. In the Rambam's time, and more accurately, immediately following the Rambam's death in 1204, a huge controversy erupted as to whether or not his works should be accepted. Right? The most volatile that this got was in the 1230s, when things completely erupted, which we'll get to in due time. And in the 1230s, the controversy actually culminated in an actual burning of the Rambam's Sfarim. And we can and never will, I certainly can never appreciate what it means to burn Sfarim in 1233. But in a time where it would take somebody, when there was no printing press, several hundred hours to write over a book, to copy over a book by hand, the fact that there was multiple Sfarim burnt of the Rambam, never mind the fact that its accessibility was vastly diminished as a result, the statement that it made, that we were taking hundreds of hours of people's work and dedication to Jewish scholarship and burning it, was a huge, huge statement as to the level of vehemence that the Rambam was opposed. Okay, in order to get into the story, though, we need to have a little bit of a background of who the Rambam was. So I'm going to take 5 minutes and do a short biography. I recommend, actually, I was just talking to Michael about this. This book, Maimonides' Life and Thought by Moshe Halbertal, it was originally written in Hebrew and published, I think, 3 or 4 years ago. It was translated into English. The first chapter of this book is a 100-page biography of the Rambam. That is, first of all, it reads like a mystery novel. It reads like a thriller, and it is absolutely magnificent. So I highly, highly recommend it. If anybody wants to borrow my copy, you can. If there's multiple requests, then I guess we can make some photostats of it. But the Rambam's biography is, as is the case with a lot of rabbinic figures who did not usually indulge, at least in the Middle Ages, in autobiography. We don't know as much. They didn't write explicitly about their own events of life and of their own lives, and we have to piece them together. Rabbinic biographies such as this are really just an absolute treasure, and this one is really as good as it gets. So I highly recommend it to everyone. So who was the Rambam? The Rambam was born in 1138 in Cordoba, Spain. Okay, I have in page 2 of this, I have a very crude map of a bunch of the places that we're talking about. Cordoba, I didn't even label this one. I put this together really quickly. Cordoba is the middle dot in the south middle of Spain. Okay, we'll get to all of you.
Really?
No, it's this one. Right? Sorry, I should have labeled it.
Fez off. 1 second.
We'll get the Fez in a minute. So he was born in 1138 in Spain. So he was born to a prominent rabbinic family. His father, Maimon Hadayim, was known as the Dayan. He was renowned as the Dayan, as the chief rabbinic authority in Cordoba. Cordoba had a very rich rabbinic tradition. The Rambam was an inheritor of a line of rabbinic tradition that was celebrated not just throughout Spain but worldwide. The most celebrated figure of this time, of this era and this region, was the Rif, Rav Yitzchak Alfasi, who lived two generations before the Rambam. He died in 1103 in Spain. And the Maimon Adayan's teacher was a guy named Rav Yitzchak ibn Migash, though known as the Rimigash in halachic literature. The Rimigash was also a world famous Andalusian Spanish Jew who was a renowned rabbinic authority. The Rambam was an inheritor of this tradition. He was taught by his father. The Rambam referred to the teachers of his father and the progenitors of this Andalusian Spanish rabbinic tradition as his own teachers. Till the day he died, the Rambam referred to himself as Moshe ben Maimon Hasfardi. And as we'll see, he left Spain as a 10-year-old. But so even though the vast majority of his illustrious life was lived outside of Spain, and really out far, far on the other, what was considered then the other side of the world, when he eventually made it to Egypt, the fact that he considered himself a child of Spain is very telling as to his own self-perception and who his character was. He was Spanish through and through, and because of that, he saw in himself an authority that came down from the great and grand rabbinic tradition of Spanish Jewry. What is usually referred to in the history books as the golden age the Jewish golden age of Spain. Right, which ended with the Spanish conquest of Spain, which happened in the Rambam's, or at least in the section of Spain that he lived in the Rambam's lifetime. As we see, so he was born in 1138 in Cordoba. In 1148, the Spain was invaded by the Almohads. They were a Muslim group from North Africa, and the Rambam's family fled from Cordoba, and he moved around. He moved around for a bunch of years. They were going from place to place to place to place. There is strong evidence. And the scholarly literature actually addresses this. There's strong evidence that the Rambam had to fake a conversion to Islam in order to sustain himself and not be, whether it was persecution or death or I don't know, that the Rambam actually faked a conversion to Islam as a result. And for all of these years, he was living, they were an itinerant family, moving from place to place to place. We actually know very, very little about this period of time. What we do know is that however they were going from place to place, or wherever it is that they were, the Rambam was receiving a very, very serious education from his father. And he spoke about that, and he does make mention of it. In 1160, the Maimonides family, they settle in Fez, Morocco, which, if you look on the map, is really not very far from, not very far, like what we would consider very far, from where Cordoba is. That's the one dot in Morocco on the bottom here, right? It's right over the strait. Yeah, bottom left. It's right over the Straits of Gibraltar. So they made it to Fez, and in Fez is where the Rambam probably received the most, really the only formal and most significant parts of his education in his life. In Fez is where the Rambam actually attended medical school, and there's actually I think it's called the University of Kairouan or something to that effect, or the Kairouanese University. Mashu kaze, is apparently, I mean, at least according to what I read online, is the oldest continually functioning institution of higher learning in the world. And this is where they actually had a formal medical school, whatever medical school was in the 13th and the 12th century. The Rambam attended while he was living in Fez and had his medical education there. So he not only was being educated by his father, he not only was moving around, trying to escape the Almohad invasion, but he also finally achieved some stability in 1160 and started his medical education. That happened, which we'll see in one moment, ended up having significant impact on his life because it's what he ended up using to make a livelihood in Spain, in Egypt, when he eventually wound up there. So. But the truth is, they actually didn't stay in Fez for that long. If you do the math, in 1160. So how old was the Rambam in 1160? If he was born in 1138, so he's 22. So he's still a young man.
Same time he started medical
school. All right. So I guess you're right. It's around the same time that you start medical school today. But they only stayed in Fez for about 5 years. So maybe that was the 5 years that the Rambam needed in medical school. I don't know. But they were in Fez for a relatively short period, and then. They had to leave Fez as well. So the Rambam, like you said, I mean, unfortunately, this is not a story that we are, that's foreign to us, and it's not really not, unfortunately, foreign throughout Jewish history, that this is the type of life that so many Jews lived, where they were not welcome, and they felt that they were not welcome, or they were physically expelled from wherever they happened to have been. The Rambam was forced out of a number of different places. So with this immense, significant Jewish education that he had from his father, and with this proud Andalusian Spanish rabbinic tradition that he received from his father, and the self-perception that he was the last in the line. The Rambam felt very strongly about this, that the light of the exile, the most significant aspects of the Jewish exile were being maintained and guarded in Spanish Jewry. And the fact that Spanish Jewry was destroyed by these events made the Rambam feel about himself that he was like almost the last guardian of the Jewish faith. Right? The Rambam, in the Rambam's entire life, he never was around a learned community the way he was in his early years in Spain. Even in his time in Fez, and certainly when he gets to Egypt, he was never around other learned scholars. He ended up striking up a correspondence with foreign rabbinic communities towards the end of his life. And in the Rambam's writings, it's like you see this flowering of excitement of his because he finally has people who we think are his intellectual peers that he can converse with. In his entire life, from the point that he's in Fez, really throughout, he feels that he is the last of the Mohicans. He's the last person to be able to defend the Jewish faith and the only one to have the authority to be able to do so. So, 1165, the family leaves Morocco, and they make their way. They make their way all over the place, and then they actually spend for a short time. They spend time in Israel. Whether the Rambam was planning on staying or not, we're not sure. But we have letters of the Rambam talking about the short time that he spent in Israel. About this guy Pinchas Hadayon from Akko, who met him at the port and gave him a tour. The Rambam says in a letter explicitly that he actually went to Har Habayis and davened there. Don't tell any of the people who oppose such things, but the Rambam actually says that he did it. Whether he actually stood at the Kotel and davened, or whether or not he went up to Har Habayis, again he doesn't specify. But the Rambam does explicitly say that he davened on or next to Har Habayis. I think he says that it's on. And it's a short time in Israel. And the Rambam describes, as we know from many other sources, this was not a time to be able to live and sustain any kind of livelihood in Israel. It was a wasteland. It was desolate. It was empty. The Crusaders came in and they wiped out pretty much everything of any value that was going on there. The Crusades actually, which is predates the Rambam. The first Crusade was in 1096, but the Crusades actually end up playing an important role in what vaults the Rambam to international acclaim. So after this stay in Israel doesn't really work out, around he makes his way to Egypt. So in 1166, the Rambam settles in Egypt. In Fustat, which is now what is today basically the old city of Cairo. So it was the old city, which was a bustling metropolis of the time, a huge Jewish community, And the Rambam settles there, not necessarily to take on the mantle of rabbinic leadership. He went with his whole family, and they settle in there. And at this point, the Rambam basically attaches himself to a local shul, the same way that you think about the model that we have in Europe. It's very, very similar. He attaches himself to a local shul, small base medrash that's attached to this local shul, and he ends up immersing himself in full-time study. All right. Now, we know that the Rambam, again, was an inheritor of the great rabbinic tradition. We also know that he was so busy running around, I don't know how he had possibly ever had the stability to become the great genius and gaon that he was, armed with all the knowledge that he was. But he did make all that happen. And he attaches himself to this little yeshiva and is immersing himself in full-time study. And the plan of the family was to give... He had a younger brother who was David ben Maimon, who was a ship merchant. He was the businessman. And the plan was that his brother was going to... they were going to put all the family wealth into his brother, and he was going to invest it, and he was going to support the family. So this was the Rambam's way of being able to maintain full-time Torah study by having his brother, maintain the family fortune. That was the original plan. So that's in fact what happens is at this point at 1166, where the Rambam first settles in Cairo, that he starts writing the Mishnah Torah. The Mishnah Torah, the Rambam's famous work, which is what he is most known for today, internationally renowned, perhaps one of the most masterful pieces of literature written ever. And I did say that, yes, ever. The Rambam, the more you learn, I can't emphasize this enough, the more I have learned Gemara, and the more I have learned Rambam, the more I have become completely enamored of what the Rambam was able to do. And the fact that he was able to do it without a computer, and without being able to do an internet search or a Bar Ilan search of different things, and the fact that he had such a level of mastery of every word written in Chazal, all in his head, and being able to, having the genius of recollection, but he was a master writer, the likes of which we have seen very little in the history of civilized society. The Rambam was an absolute master of the pen, and he used the full force of his knowledge and his skill and his tradition in composing for over the course of about 10 years the Mishnah Torah. All right. He was engaged in it for about 10 years. The first five or six of which he was able to do in full time. But the family tragedy was that in 1177, around 1171, he ends up being appointed the chief rabbi of the community. All right. So in 1171, if he's born in 1138, so how old is he there? All right. So he's about 30. Right, 33. So he's in his 30s. The Rambam is a pretty young guy, but not only his genius, but you have to imagine in this locale, the celebrated Andalusian Spanish rabbinic community that he was from was very much legendary throughout the Jewish world. So the Rambam being an ambassador of that community, which is now an endangered species because it was driven out of its home. So the Rambam immediately, just based on his stature, his family, was pegged as somebody significant. And then over the first years, he demonstrated his genius. And I mentioned before, I actually didn't put it in here, but the Crusades played an important part of this. There was a group of Jews that were captured in the Crusades, and they were ransomed, and the Rambam basically led the effort to collect money to get back these groups of Jews. That event, some scholars speculate, was actually what put the Rambam on the map of Egyptian Jewry. And in 1171, which is not long after that episode, I believe, they appoint him the head rabbi, the chief rabbi of this position was called the Nagid, the chief rabbi of the Cairo Jewish community. So the Rambam is engaged in this, and for the next few years, he's finishing up his Mishnah Torah. 1177, there's a great tragedy in the family, and the brother David, who's in charge of the family finances, dies at sea in the Indian Ocean, trying to actually establish a trade route with India. All right, it's a story that we can appreciate here. Also, it was a fool's mission. Actually, the Rambam says that he begged his brother not to engage in it, and his brother dies. So because of that, the Rambam was forced into getting a job, right? He no longer was able to rely on his brothers sustaining the family, and he had to go get a job. So in 1178, the Rambam actually began practicing medicine. That was, you know, he dusted off his medical degree from his the days of Yor and Fez, and he starts practicing medicine. Within a short period of time, the Rambam, who was renowned already as the rabbinic figure, the Nagid, I should mention, the Nagid was not only a rabbinic and halachic position, it was a political one. You couldn't become the Nagid in Egypt without the approval of the Muslim authorities, though, their local Muslim authorities. So the Rambam was already a household name before he starts practicing medicine. Then he starts practicing medicine, and everybody sees that he happens to be this, not only this genius halachic master, but also this very capable doctor. And eventually he becomes, within a short order, he becomes the personal physician of the second in command in all of Egypt. All right, so this is the Rambam's rise to meteoric rise to fame and throughout Egyptian Jewry. Now, despite the fact that he was, the Rambam writes in the 1190s, he has this account of what his day looked like, and I don't know how he had time to, you know, the fact that I sometimes complain that I don't have any time to learn is comical when you consider what the Rambam actually had to go through. He describes, like, hour by hour what his day looks like, and why he can't meet with anybody, and he says he's so tired at the end of the day that he actually needs to lie down, because he lacks the physical strength to stand on his feet. This is at the end of his day. We all think that we're tired. It was translated and published in an article in Tradition a few years ago. So you should just you can read this letter. I think they titled it, you know, an autobiographical sketch by Rabbi Dr. Moses Maimonides, something like that. So you can read it. Rambam was extremely busy, and his time was being pulled in a lot of different directions. And the fact that he was able to do anything, let alone maintain his mastery and correspondence with halachic correspondence with many communities, the Rambam penned hundreds of halachic responsa, and he was extremely significant. Now, in the 1190s, where the Rambam was now serving as the personal physician to the royal vizier, that's where the Rambam wrote his last and most controversial work on Judaism. And that is known as the Mora HaNevuchim. All right? Often mislabeled as the Mora Nivuchim, it's known as the Mora HaNivuchim. So how you translate its title is actually going to depend on what you say that hey is. So the Rambam writes the Mora Nivuchim is actually very different than any of his previous works. The Rambam writes the Mora Nivuchim in response to a request by a former student of his who now lives in Alexandria, and his student is also a master of the rabbinic texts, rabbinic works, and the student says, "I got some real questions about some basic principles of what it means to be Jewish. How do you conceive of God? What does it mean that God? You know, there's so many references throughout the Torah of God doing physical things. Vayechar af Hashem, God's nose flares. God doesn't have a nose, or does God have a nose? Is God somewhere out there in the ether that we can't see, but He's there? Does He have a body? Does He not have a body? How are we meant to conceive of God?" And in response to this, the Rambam starts writing the Mora Nevuchim. He actually writes it in three different parts and sends them to his student, Rabbi Yosef Bar Yehuda, Joseph, son of Judah of Alexandria, I believe. 99% sure that was his name. Joseph of Judah of Alexandria. And in the 1180s he's starting this. And then in 1191 he finally sends in the third and final section. Now, in the Mora Nevuchim, the Rambam writes explicitly that this is supposed to be for private consumption only. You're not allowed to share it with anybody because this is between you and I. Okay? The Rambam himself relaxes that restriction, but he was adamant throughout all of his days that the Mora Nevuchim was only meant for the elite. It was not meant for... Yeah, in our terminology, it ends up going viral, and the story of it going viral is actually part of our narrative for today. The Rambam wrote the Mora Nevuchim, basically saying that it's inconceivable for somebody to be able not only to be able to understand, but to be able to appreciate any of these very significant issues of theology and philosophy without having a firm grasp of Chazal's literature, without having a firm grasp of the halachic tradition. And if you don't, the Rambam not only said that it's not for you, he said you're not really going to understand it properly. You'll never get it. And the Rambam, I mean, esotericism in the Rambam is another big topic discussed in the scholarly literature. The Rambam basically says that he not only is writing this for only the knowledgeable crowd, but he wrote the Mora Nevuchim. He says this about his own literature. I wrote it in a way that it's masked, it's hidden. The actual meaning of what I wrote, you'll never get unless you are an elite scholar. And that means, I mean, what the Rambam is essentially saying is that the surface meaning of what I wrote isn't really what it's about. You're only going to be able to understand it if you have, those little codes that you used to get in cereal boxes in order to decode some message about how you need to go buy more cereal, right? So the Rambam was basically saying the only way that you're going to get your decoder is if you learn. And if you're not a great scholar, you'll never have the decoder and you're never going to understand it. So that was the Rambam writing the Mor Nebuchim. In the Rambam's time, all right, the Mor Nebuchim, the two works of the Rambam that we need to be armed with in order to understand what we're discussing this morning, are the Mor Nebuchim, which addresses all of these philosophical topics, and the second work that we need to be aware of is the first section of the Mishneh Torah. Right, the Mishneh Torah, which has 14 books, right, the first of which is known as Sefer Hamada. Sefer Hamada deals with the Mishneh Torah is a purely a halachic work. The Rambam started off by giving a list of all 613 mitzvot, and through the Mishneh Torah, he's explicating all the details of each of the 613 mitzvot, one by one by one by one by one. And in doing so, he's summarizing without attribution and without sources, but he's summarizing the entirety of Chazal's literature and using the rabbinic tradition that existed until his time, that the areas in which he saw as being relevant. So that was what the Rambam was doing. The first section, Sefer Hamada, deals with mitzvot that we would consider to be philosophical in nature, right? The mitzvah of belief in God, the mitzvah of repentance. The mitzvah, the prohibition of serving idols, of worshiping idols, right? These types of things are the things that the Rambam, who in the same halachic language that he uses to describe how to shake a lulav and esrog, he also is describing what it is that you need to believe in when you believe in God, right? What is God? What is not God? What does it mean when God says, in several places in Chazal, that there's going to be resurrection? All right. What does it mean that what does it mean that God is going to forgive you or not going to forgive you? What is the concept of tshuva? So that was the first issue that we need to contend with is what the Rambam's view of is resurrection, and that was one of the first things that the second thing that really sparked debate. The first thing that really sparked debate is something that the Rambam states explicitly in his introduction to the code, to the Code of Jewish Law. That's the English title for the Mishneh Torah. The Rambam basically says, all right, and keep in mind, the reason why I think that this introduction is so important is because of what the Rambam thinks about himself. All right. Well, one of my professors used to say, I really should point out. I took several courses with Dr. David Berger, one of which was the course in the Maimonidean controversy. A lot of what I'm 99% of what I'm saying right now is a direct result of Dr. Berger's courses. I owe a tremendous debt to him. He is my revered teacher, and his courses were just really incredible. So the Rambam writes. The introduction is so important because the Rambam sees himself as this last remnant of a rabbinic tradition that was responsible, right? The extent to which he was aware of the wider Jewish world, we can discuss, but he saw himself and his community as being the source of the main guardians of rabbinic tradition. Right? There was a time when we discussed this in previous lectures in the previous series that we've had. There was for 800 years, 700 years after the sealing of the Talmud, the main center of Judaism was in what remained in Babylonia, remained in what is now Iraq. And even in the Rambam's day, there was still a center of Torah learning, a center of yeshiva in Iraq. And Baghdad was a huge center of halachic Judaism. But the Rambam felt very much that in the previous centuries, they had basically given way to the authority of the Spanish Jewry. Spanish Jewry basically took up the mantle of where the Babylonian Iraqi Jewry had, and now the Babylonian Jewry were basically second rate, and they were more obsessed with their own stature than they were with the actual content and meaning of Torah and halacha. So because of that, the Rambam saw it as his responsibility, as this last remnant of this, the people entrusted with guarding halachic tradition, as writing everything that he could in as organized a possible way as he could, based on this stature and based on this tradition, everything that everybody in the Jewish world needed to know, because he genuinely believed that if he didn't, things could be lost. The Rambam, so he used the full power of his capability, the full power of all of his skill and knowledge, in order to, he harnessed it all to try and create this work of the Mishneh Torah to guard halachic Judaism for posterity. What he produced is quite something. He writes, all right, and I guess we'll jump right into this. We'll get into the other characters as they come up. But he writes, let's go to source number 1 on page 3. So he writes in the, you know something, we'll start with, let's start with source number three, okay? Source number three, on page three. All right, the Rambam is writing, he's describing this Hakdama, fascinating text. I have it in translation if anybody's ever interested. But you should try and read it in the original Hebrew. It's only two or three pages long. The Rambam is setting out and explaining. He goes through the entirety of Jewish history leading till his day, and explaining why he needs to do what he's doing in writing the Mishnah Torah. And the theme that really jumps out is what I've been mentioning about guarding a halakhic tradition, seeing himself as that guardian. Kulam b'lashon brura v'derech tzara. All right, he's previously said, I described all 613 mitzvot and all of their diktukim, and he did everything b'lashon brura v'derech tzara. He did everything in clear language and in short form. Achetehei Torah shebal peh kula sedura b'fi akol. So the entirety of Torah shebal peh is going to be set and understood by everybody, and it's going to be arranged for everyone. Belo kushya v'lo piruk, and it's not going to have any division or any discussion. Lo is the Elmer Bakav, is the Elmer Bakav. You don't have the debates that the Talmud is fraught with. Ella, third line in source number three. Dvarim brurim krovim nechonim al pi hamishpat asher yitba'er mikol elu achiburim vahapirushim hanimtzaim mimot Rabbeinu Hakadosh v'ad achshav. What are you going to have? You're going to have a clear decision about every halachic debate that's happened since the time of Rabbeinu Hakadosh, the way he refers to Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the final redactor of the Mishnah. You're going to have that. You're going to have every halakha question that's come up in the last 900 years since Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi passed. You're going to have a clear decision about. Achiyu kol adinim gluyim lekatan lagadol b'din kol mitzvah u'mitzvah b'din kol dvarim shetiknu chachamim nevim. Ad kedei kach, until the point that you're going to have a separate decision for every halakha question of the day. Klalo shel davar, the idea being kedei shelo yehei adam tzarich lechibur acher ba'olam. B'din midinei Yisrael. When it comes to Jewish law, when it comes to halacha, you're not going to need any other book other than mine. All right? You think that this is? You can imagine an author writing like this. Ella yehei chibur zeh mekabetz la Torah shebal peh kula. It's going to encompass all of Torah shebal peh. Ima takanot v'aminhagot v'agzerot shenasu mimot Moshe Rabbeinu v'ad chibur agmara. Every single law, every single prat from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu until the sealing of the Gemara around the 7th century, or 6th century, 7th century. And not only that, but it's going to include all of the halachic work that happened subsequent to the sealing of the Gemara.
Since then, anybody found out that he missed something? Or?
Well, we'll read the Ravad in a second, but it's not since then. Basically, to use our parlance, the second the Rambam hit send on the email of this text, all right, he was getting the blogs were going crazy on. All right, let's go. Lefikach, all right, we're in the fourth to last line of source three. Lefikach karati shem achibur zeh mishne Torah, the review of the Torah. Levisha Adam Koreba Torah Shibichtav Tchila. He's going to read the Torah Shibichtav. He's going to read Tanakh. Va'achar kach Koreba Zeh. He's going to read the Mishneh Torah. Ve'yodeh mimenu Torah Shibal Peh Kula. And through reading these two things, he'll know everything. Ve'eino tzarich likrot sefer acher b'nehem. So basically, the Rambam was making it that you need only the Tanakh and the Mishneh Torah, and you're all set. You don't need anything else. Now, if you a typical rabbinic library, even in the days before printing presses back then, had quite a few more books than the Tanakh and the Mishneh Torah. And the Rambam was, you know, at least in plain sight over here, what he seems to be saying is that your average Joe does not need, or not even your average Joe, everybody doesn't need anything but a Tanakh and his Sefer. Okay? Now, to keep in mind everything that I was saying before, the Rambam is coming to you with thinking of himself as the guardian of this rabbinic tradition, not totally aware of the extent of rabbinic scholarship in the wider world, genuinely thinking that if he doesn't do this, what will happen? Right? He really thinks that this is a great grand effort to protect the integrity of halachic Judaism, and he genuinely believes in his own authority. All right? In other places, I didn't really put them here, but in other places, he invests himself with so much rabbinic authority because of these traditions, because of his education, because of his parentage, and because of the locale in which he was born, and the culture in which he was from. Because of all of these factors, he finds in himself so much authority, the authority necessary in order to do this endeavor. So, that was not All right. As incredible as it was quite scandalous at the time. So the Ra'avad, all right, and we need to know a little bit about who the Ra'avad was, right? He's the second of the characters mentioned on page 1. So he was born in 1120 in Narbonne, all right, and he died in Pasquier in 1198. So the Ra'avad is most known today as what? Everybody knows the Rambam Ravid. What do we know about the Rambam Ravid? Right, the Ravid is known most today as a critic of the Rambam, the Maimonidean critic, the greatest of the Maimonidean critics, of the critics of the Rambam. Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik wrote the seminal article on the biography of the Ravad. Again, just to make, I mean, reading Dr. Soloveitchik is like reading a thriller. I can't recommend him enough. Layman and scholar alike, he's really magnificent to read, and he has this article about the Ra'avad in which he goes through in his time all the proofs that he sees as why the Ra'avad was a world famous first class halachic authority irrespective of the Rambam. And in his time, people didn't even know that he was writing Hasagot on the Rambam, right? Because he was so much. He's exactly the type of person that the Rambam didn't know existed. All right, it was unaware of, at least to the extent of his knowledge. Anyway, the Ra'avad, who thought of himself quite a bit as well, gets his hands on the Mishneh Torah in, if you want to know where he was, Pasquier is in southern France. Southern France is Provence. You know, it's a little bit of an ambiguous territory over here, but it's going to loom large in our discussion of what happened in the reception of the Rambam. So the Ra'avad receives a copy of the Mishneh Torah, which went viral. Mishneh Torah really did go viral. And the Rambam actually tracked very meticulously where the Mishneh Torah was going. He reports in letters that he was writing in the 1190s about how he knows that it reached this locale, and he knows that the Rabbanim in this area wrote to him, and they said that they received the copy. The Rambam was very serious about making this. The Rambam oversaw the copying of copies of his Mishneh Torah. The main copy, the authoritative copy, was in his own handwriting. That was in his house. The people were paid to come in, take the Rambam's handwritten copy, copy it over, and then the Rambam would go through these copies and sign off. I did this one. I don't know if anybody's ever seen it. We have a signature of the Rambam on a fragment of on a manuscript in the Huntington manuscript is what it's called. The Huntington manuscript is a manuscript that we have of the first two Sfarim of the Mishneh Torah. This was one of the copies that the Rambam, it used to be complete, but the Rambam writes at the first page of this manuscript that we have, which I believe is in the Bodleian Library in Oxford University. So the Rambam writes on the first cover page of this, Huga Misifri. I checked this book, and it is in the Rambam's handwriting, which we have several examples of. I checked this book, and it's thumbs up. He actually asterisks and makes a few corrections throughout the thing, and again in the Rambam's own handwriting. Just fascinating. To somebody who spent so many years studying the Rambam, and you open up a page like that and you see the Rambam wrote on it and say, "Who got me see free?" and then he makes a correction, it's as exciting as it gets. So the Rambam, and then the famous signature that we have of the Rambam is on this manuscript where he writes, "Who got me see free? Ani Moshe ben Maimon Asfardi Mashu Kaza." Okay. So the Rambam sees to it that these books go all over the place. The Ra'avad gets his hands on a copy because it went viral and made it all the way to Provence, to southern France. And the Ra'avad is livid, absolutely livid. He said the Rambam is a kook. He doesn't know what he's talking about. And not only that, but he's denigrating, flying in the face of every rabbi that has ever lived. There is a way we do things. There is a way we conduct ourselves. And it is not this. This is not the way rabbis write. This is not the way rabbis act. This is not the way rabbis teach. We don't spit in the face, which is what the Rambam thought the Rambam was doing. We don't spit in the face of our forebears. That's not the way it works. Says the Rambam. The Rambam and some of his comments, some of his critiques written in the margins of the Mishneh Torah, which the Rambam wrote in the margins of the copy that he had, which eventually were copied down and printed in some of the earliest printings of the Rambam. In the earliest printing of the Rambam, the Ravad's Hasagot were included, which is why they've been included in every other printing since then, except for one that my father-in-law bought me a couple of years ago, which is actually magnificent, but story for another time. Savar Latakein Velo Tikein, says the Ravad on this comment that we just read about the rabbinic authority, and all you need is my book and the Tanakh. Sabar latakein velo tikein. The Rambam, all right, although he did not call the Rambam the Rambam, he called this guy, or Hamachaber, all right, who he very often has some choice words for. He said he tried to fix things, he tried to help things, velo tikein. He didn't do squat. Ki hu azav derech kol hamechabrim asher hayu lefanav. He left the tradition of every single author before him, every single rabbinic work before him, rabbinic figure. Kehem hevi uraya ledivrehem. Read through the Mishnah Torah. The Mishnah Torah doesn't include rayot. He doesn't explain himself. He just says, this is the law. And every rabbinic authority before preceding the Rambam thought it necessary, thought it required of them to explain why they thought the halakha was X and not Y. And the Rambam decides, you should trust me based on my own authority, based on my tradition, based on my knowledge, that the halakha is X and not Y, and you don't need to worry about it. Third line, second word, all these past rabbinic authorities wrote what they wrote in the name of who they were writing. They would say, not only do I think that the halakha is X and not Y, not only am I going to give you the reason, but this rabbi agrees with me, and that rabbi agrees with me, a long tradition. The Rambam did none of that. He didn't quote names. And why do we need to quote names? Why do we need to quote rationales when we are rabbinic authorities writing halachic works? There was an important reason for it. Ki pa'amim rabot, all the time, ya'leh alev, I'm turning to page 4, ya'leh hadayan le'esoro lahatir. A person is going to see whether or not they are going to either permit or prohibit a particular thing. And their source for doing so is going to be such and such a source. The Gemara says this, the Midrash says this, the Yerushalmi says this. That's where my source is. The ilu yada ki yesh gadol mimenu. And if the author of this psak, this rabbinic decision, knew that there is a rabbi of greater stature other than him, hiflik shmuato ladat acheret hayachoz, right? Hiflik shmuato ladat acheret hayachozer bo. What's he going to do? He's going to change his mind. Right? Or somebody, the person hearing it, is going to change his mind. The way we do this, if I say that the halakha is X, and my source is the Pillsbury Doughboy box, which I read, and I interpreted to mean that the halakha is X and not Y, then anybody who reads my halakhic decision is going to be able to say, alright, I hold of the Shulchan Aruch more than the Pillsbury Doughboy box, so yeah, I don't care what the Pillsbury Doughboy box says, your decision is meaningless. Yeah.
But isn't he, in a way, complaining about the method that the Rambam used, not the end result,
yes,
firstly?
Absolutely.
And secondly, that's not what the Rambam wanted to accomplish. The Rambam says, I want to accomplish a concise book without these details.
Right. So basically what the Rambam is writing, and he says it, you know, you have to read the whole Hakdama to get it, and some other places where he describes why he did what he did and how he did it. But the Rambam, for the Rambam, what makes halakhic literature not concise and what makes it unclear to the layman and to the rabbi alike, what makes it unclear is all of the discussion, all of the noise about debates and debates and debates and debates. For the Rambam, and this is in fact echoed today in the Sephardic tradition championed by Rabbi Avadi Yosef about how to learn, how to properly study Gemara, debates are not inherently valuable. I mean, the world of Lithuanian Jewry and Brisk couldn't be more diametrically opposed to this. And ironically, what they hold of exactly using the Rambam, because they said this is how the Rambam did, but the Rambam didn't believe in debates. He thought that there was no value in knowing, you know, in hearing all six shittot in the Gemara, if in the end we only pass them like one of them. So
there's value in debate, but once you decide on one
for halachic, for halachic decision, which is how we'd have to say, all right, and that's what Reb Chaim said. Reb Chaim said the Rambam wasn't disavowing Talmud Torah, you know, outright. He was saying in the world of psak halacha, in the world of deciding, making a halachic decision, debates are not helpful. All they do is serve to confuse people. So the Rambam said, look, I'm the man, I know everything, I got all this knowledge in me, I have all this tradition, I have all this rabbinic authority, trust me, I'm also a master writer, trust me, I'm just going to give you the answer, and you don't need to worry about it. The rabbi said, in trying to make things easier, in trying to make things more concise and more understandable, you're completely flying in the face of what a psak halacha is. You can't not give people the opportunity to disagree with you. Right? And the Rambam thought, I'm smarter than everyone in the world, and I know more than everybody in the world, and I can, and I will, and I did, write a halachic decision without people having the opportunity to disagree with me. And the Ravad is suspect of the Rambam, is suspicious of the Rambam for you know, basically duping everyone, right?
Do you think the Rambam wrote that way because his book was more for the common man, because he either didn't mean it for any other gedolim, Or he didn't think there were other Gedolim around. Like
So remember what I said about how the Rambam was a master writer. All right, the Rambam was leagues beyond Shakespeare. I think that the Rambam, one of the things that is so masterful about the Mishneh Torah and why the Rambam was such a masterful writer is that he was able to write for both of the categories that you just described. The layman is able to read it and get the bottom line halakha, but the master who knows Chazal's literature and knows the formulations in the Gemara and the Yerushalmi and the Midrashim, they're able to see the nuance, the genius, the brilliance of it. Look, I studied in Rabbi Rosenzweig's shir for 5 years. I for those of you who go to his shir, you know that the man is no slouch. All right. The Rosenzweig will read in a Rambam and sees 4,000 things that I don't. All right, every single one. But also your average Taimani, who actually still uses the Rambam as an authoritative code, can read the Rambam and know exactly what bracha to say and where to place his menorah when he's doing Hadlakat Neron and Hanukkah. Right, the scholar and layman alike are able to use which is one of the reasons why it was such a masterful work. And the Rambam knew that. Right? And you want to know how the Rambam did it because he said so. Right? But the Rabbad could not countenance such a ridiculous claim. Flies in the face of all rabbinic tradition. And by the way, the Rabbad thought of himself the way the Rambam thought of himself. I'm the smartest one in the, right? I'm the one who knows everything. Because I have that authority, I can tell you, Rambam, that you have absolutely no business changing the way people do things. All right? Let me just finish up the sentence, and then we'll quickly skip to the next section. He just calls him the author. He doesn't. Right? There's no deference. There's no reverence at all. The Rambam just writes one opinion. He doesn't quote the other opinions. Why the heck should I rely on his judgment? I don't know what his reasoning was. I don't know who argued with him. I don't know if the Rambam's decision is worthy of dispute or not. For the Ravad, you can't divorce halacha from the discussion of what the halacha is supposed to end up being. Alright? For the Rambam, not only can you, you should, because it's just going to cloud the matter. Okay, debate number one. This happened in the Rambam's lifetime. All right, debate number two, and we're not going to read it inside because I want to get to stage number two. This point number two that happened in the Rambam's life, I mean, this was going on. The Rambam died in 1204, right? The Ravad predeceased the Rambam, we said, he was in the 1190s, right? The Ravad died in 1198. So they lived in the same time. And I'm pretty sure that the Rambam did not, that the consensus is that the Rambam never knew of the Ravad's objections. This is actually one of Dr. Soloveitchik's main arguments about why the Ravad's objections to the Rambam in his time weren't such a big deal. Because if they were, the Rambam would have heard about them. The point is that this was very typical of criticism of the Rambam. The other area, all right, I titled the section Rabbinic Authority and Resurrection. The other area that in the Rambam's lifetime caused great controversy and which was one of the only ones that he set out to actually correct, again, in his lifetime, was the issue of Tchiyat HaMetim. Right? Tchiyat HaMetim is a very ambiguous, perplexing, to use no pun intended, perplexing concept. We all know that Tchiyat HaMetim is an essential part of our faith. It's one of the Rambam's Yud Gimel Ikarim. That if I don't believe that there is going to be a resurrection, then I'm pasul eidus. I can't be an eid at a wedding. I can't be all the things that make a person a heretic. Right? It's essential. It's an essential part of our belief. What does Tchiyat HaMetim mean?
Coming back to life.
So my grandmother always used to talk about how loses all of its time when it's not in Yiddish. It's about how everybody needed to be buried in Israel because tunneling is going to take me forever, right? I don't want to be busy tunneling, right? You think of how much time of Yimot HaMashiach that I'm going to miss out on if I have to spend all this time tunneling? I don't want to tunnel. Right? Why? I always like my question wasn't she like, why can't you like get out and get on a plane, instead of tunneling? What's the deal?
I dig it.
Right? The understanding Tchiyat HaMetim in the plain sense. All right. What happens to all the bodies after they are resurrected? Is that death is...
Their soul comes to life.
What happens? Do we no longer have death?
Are they old? No, are they young? Yeah.
My grandmother, Alea Shalom, who died 3 years ago, she's now no longer around. So does her flesh take new form? Is it skeletons that are going to be walking around? Is it going to be spirits that are walking around?
What?
And is death now gone? Are we going to take the nevuah Bila Hamavet Lanetzach Lamacha Hashem Dimamei Al Kopanim? Literally, Bila Hamavet Lanetzach, the death is actually going to be completely eradicated. So the answer is, I don't know, right? Not the correct answer is this is a subject of intense debate. Intense debate.
Right.
Chazal, yeah. Please.
When did Tchiyat HaMetim even become a topic in our canon of literature?
It's in the Nevi'im, and Chazal take it very literally. Chazal talk about Tchiyat HaMetim in many, many literal ways. And
you go, the first page of the Amidah, it's written like 20 times.
Yeah, well, but it doesn't explain what Tchiyat HaMetim is.
It doesn't tell you where it came from.
Well, it's written.
It's just that God is going to resurrect the dead. Again, practically, what does that mean? None of us have ever seen it happen, so we don't know what it means. The Rambam had a very unique opinion that he outlines about what resurrection is.
You can't be a good Jew, Ashkenazi or Sephardim, unless you believe
that there is going to be resurrection. Exactly.
Right. Because when did that belief start?
It helps you.
When did you
in
say
this
you
life?
Can't be a good Jew?
Whatever happens in this life, you know it'll be rectified in the next.
Well, that's not. You don't need Tchiyat HaMetim for that. That's Olam Haba, right?
Right. Right.
Right. That's like eternity. And I agree with you, right? Which is also another tenet of our faith. But Tchiyat HaMetim, which is a separate tenet, that yes, there is an Olam Haba, but there's also going to be a resurrection, is a basic tenet of Judaism. Like you said, we daven for it every single day. We praise HaKadosh Baruch Hu for being Mechayei HaMetim. But you ask your average Joe on the street what Tchiyat HaMetim means. And ask your average rabbi what Tchiyat HaMetim means. They'll either say, they'll either give you a straight answer, in which case they are not right, because there's a wide range of understandings of what this means, which is the case in many areas of Jewish philosophy. And I would urge you to be critical of any rabbi that ever tells you an ambiguous area of Jewish philosophy that there is any one understanding of what it means, because this kind of stuff is debated. Does the study of Torah actually sustain the world's existence?
Yes.
Okay, so that was a trick question. The answer is maybe. Depends on who you. It depends on who you're going
to
read. Ruchaim Volozhiner very much took that concept literally, and he's saying that if we,
ongoing.
We're not debating the significance of Talmud Torah, but literally whether the universe would cease to exist if Talmud Torah ever stopped. Is something that became very, very popular in the 18th century when the 19th century, when Chaim Volozhiner wrote about it.
What?
Well put.
Wait, what did she say?
We'll get to it. I don't think it made it to the recording.
Could you belay that recording?
No, we're good.
No, I want to belabor
this. You see, Esther, when I sit down, everything gets so much more relaxed, and it's much less of a feel of a lecture. It's okay.
That says the rabbi's daughter.
Esther always
says the rabbi's daughter.
Okay.
She's
from the other camp, by the way.
In the Midbar, when the Jews were in the Midbar, were the rabbis saying, don't worry, you have to eat man every day. It's no big deal. In the Olam Haba, it'll be wonderful.
I have no idea. I wasn't there.
Right.
Okay.
I mean, it's not mentioned.
Olam Haba's lack of a mention in Tanakh is a really important discussion, which is taken up by the commentaries that are trying to understand what Olam Haba is. Kabbalah has a different take on all of this. All right. Anyway.
That's everybody's serious question.
Yeah.
What does the Rambam define Tchiyat?
So for that, I'm going to tell you to read source number 5 on your own time. Okay? The Rambam in Hilchot Tshuva in chapter 8 actually takes a stance on this, which ends up being extremely controversial. All right? It's complicated. The Rambam has this complicated idea where basically everybody is going to be physically resurrected and then die again. All right? Which drove people bonkers, absolutely nuts, that they thought that, like, the Rambam, you're flying again in the face of so many different Mamarei Chazal. And the Rambam basically thought that a lot of these Mamarei Chazal are not to be meant to be taken literally. This is a cause for controversy. I spent an entire semester of graduate school spending hours and hours and hours a day on this topic. So we're obviously not going to address it. We can't get into the nuanced details of what the Rambam did and did not think. What you need to know for the purposes of this discussion is that he had an opinion about Tchiyat HaMetim. He liked the Ravid, criticized him for it. Didn't really talk about what his rationale for that opinion was, or his sources for that opinion. And he just stated it without any of that justification or source. And people went nuts. So in the Rambam's lifetime, people were criticizing him for his opinion on Tchiyat HaMetim, and what it forced him to do in his own lifetime is to write a famous letter known as the Ma'amar Tchiyat HaMetim, in which he outlines and basically has to deny the accusation that he doesn't believe in Tchiyat HaMetim. Okay? All of this is, you know, a superficial telling of this history, but that's really what happened. This source that I quoted for you over here in chapter 8 of Hilchot Tshuva, which is again in Sefer Amada, is one of the main texts that people were addressing. Yeah.
You said Olam Haba is a different concept than Tchiyat HaMetim. How can you have one without the other?
I didn't say that you can have one without the other, right? But they are a different concept. One is talking about a person's eternity and where they go after death. And one is talking about
physical. One is physical, one is spiritual.
Well, not necessarily.
One's talking about resurrection and eternity are two different things, aren't they?
I'm not saying
that after the resurrection the person's not going to be able to talk to you about what Olam Haba was like. But they're not unrelated, but they're different. They're two different concepts.
Yeah, they're different, but if you are saying Olam Haba's standard thought or faith, doesn't that lead into Tchiyat HaMetim?
Yeah. What it is going to be an important part question of where the people were when they come back. Yeah, 100%.
So you're only talking like a little detail in a way.
No, I think they're two very independent concepts.
Detail?
They're related, but independent
with
concepts.
The flesh, without
okay,
the flesh.
Let me. I'm sorry, but we can talk more after. I just want to get a quick. I didn't put in too many sources for this because I really just want to tell the story and then read a little bit of the Ramban. Okay, the Rambam dies in 1204. The Rambam thought that he put this issue to bed. In 12, you know, when he wrote the Yeret Tchiyat HaMetim, and he thought, all right, finally the world is going to see me for what I am, for this great scholar who wrote this great work. One of my teachers once said, the Rambam very much held of the Rambam, right? That was very clear. And then he followed up by saying, if I was the Rambam, I probably also would very much hold of the Rambam, right? Point being is that the Rambam, when you are of that level of genius, I guess, you know, we can dismiss what to us laymen seems like. What appears to be haughtiness or self-centeredness, or you know, use whatever term you want. The Rambam very much did hold of the Rambam, and he thought that he put this issue to bed. He engaged with these scholars of the town of Lunil, which was in southern France in Provence, at the end of his life, and found, like I said, a wellspring of knowledge that it seems like he didn't even know existed until that point. And then basically he dies, and that's when all of the insanity starts. He dies in 1204. The next couple of decades, the people that are living in southern France start to get wind of a whole bunch of stuff. All right, in the 1190s, the Chachmei Lunil that the Rambam was conversing with, Rambam was corresponding with, they requested the Mor Nevuchim for themselves. So the Rambam acquiesces. He sends copies to Rabbi Yonatan HaKohen of Lunil, who was one of the famous world-class scholars of the day, living in southern France. He sends them the first two sections of the Mor Nevuchim. Right? And the people in southern France didn't speak a word of Arabic. The Mor Nevuchim was written in Arabic. So the Mor Nevuchim, so basically what they did is they give this stuff to Yehuda ibn Tibbon, who was from a family of illustrious translators from Arabic to Hebrew, well known for generations. They were masters of Arabic and of Hebrew, and they were translators. The Rambam knew of him, knew of the family, knew of the quality of the work, and he sanctioned a translation by Yehuda ibn Tibbon of his Mor Nevuchim. Again, for the Chachmei Lunil, for these great scholars. And he translates it, and not only that, but he follows it up by sending them a copy of Chelek Gimel. Again in Arabic, again translated. And now, for the first time, we have a full copy translated by Ibn Tibbon of the Rambam's Mor Nevuchim in Hebrew. That's when it all, you know,
I couldn't read it.
Finish my sentence, you're right? That's when everything goes completely, completely nuts. This is around when the Rambam's dying. All right, so he dies in 1204. Now, this is when it really goes viral. The Mor Nevuchim. And people start studying it, and people are fascinated with it. And there's this new, huge, immense effort on the part of, like, your average Joe in Provence to start learning this, because now all of a sudden we can understand. They're reading the Rambam and saying we can understand all those questions that we were sitting in yeshiva throughout our entire upbringing, and we would ask a question and say, Rabbi, how does it say Vayechar Rav Hashem if God didn't ever knows? And the Rebbe would smack you with a ruler and tell you to be quiet and stop being a mechutzav, right? If you're picking up on any pent up aggression, you know, right? Not entirely wrong, right? All those types of questions that everybody throughout all of Jewish history, you have to imagine, has been asking. Finally, they have an answer to it by reading the Mor Nevuchim. People start studying the Mor Nevuchim in little private study groups. People start having book clubs with the Mor Nevuchim. Average people, not elite rabbinic scholars like the Rambam intended, but average people. And the Rabbanim in Luniel go berserk. Absolutely berserk. And all of the criticisms of the Rambam from 30 years earlier, right, 30, 40 years earlier of the Rambam, he didn't believe in this, he didn't believe in that, he was a heretic, he didn't really believe in resurrection, he thinks that secular knowledge is important, he doesn't believe in Talmud Torah, he doesn't believe in halacha, he doesn't believe in rabbinic tradition. All these things start bubbling up. And everybody thinks, right? You know, think of your, I hate to, you know, use the anachronism, but think of the kid that suddenly goes off to college and sits in a class and hears a professor say that the Torah never existed and was not given by God. And they think, now armed with some guy who's in a professor of some fancy college, all of a sudden thinks that they know more than everybody in the world, and they come along and they start professing that everything, right? So we all know that you need a little bit more knowledge to actually cogently debate these issues, but that was going on. The average Joe was all of a sudden being armed with this knowledge that the Chachmei Luniel thought that they shouldn't have.
Excuse me. That time also the Karaites in Egypt. Without that,
yeah,
they would be, probably their heads would be much stronger.
Yeah.
They came out also to
all right, but that was in Egypt. That was in Egypt, and we're talking Southern France.
But this was written in Egypt.
Well, the Rambam was writing it was in Egypt, yeah.
Yeah, but this whole time, that period, not only that.
Yeah, correct. The Karaites were big. The Karaites feature very, very large in the Rambam's writings, but I don't think that. All right, but for another discussion, I just want to finish up. Okay, so what happens? So the Rambam's in. So the Luniel, the Chachmei Luniel, now are vilifying the Rambam. And this guy, Shlomo ben Avram of Montpellier, right, which again is the little short. Three-line biography on the top of page 2. Shlomo ben Avram Montpellier is one of the leading rabbinic scholars of the day. He is, Montpellier is one of the dots in southern France. He is livid at what's going on, and he calls for a ban, an actual ban of the Rambam Sfarim. Shlomo ben Avram Montpellier dispatches his prized student, Rabbeinu Yonah. You've heard of Rabbeinu Yonah, right? Rabbeinu Yonah was a household name now, right? Rabbeinu Yonah he dispatches Rabbeinu Yonah to go to northern France. Northern France, where the Chachmei Ashkenaz and the school of Ashkenaz resided, right? The hotbed of it, who did not believe in external knowledge. There wasn't. Dr. Soloveitchik likes to, is written in a few places, that there was never a word uttered or written in Latin that has come down to us, and all of the 2.5 centuries of the Chachmei Ashkenaz and Chachmei Tzarfat, the French and German rabbinic scholars, were some of the greatest in Jewish history. Not a word in Latin has ever come down to us. When you compare that to the flowering of Arabic in the Spanish Jewish tradition, it's fascinating. So he sends Rabbeinu Yonah to all of the leading rabbinic scholars in northern France and gets them to sign on to this ban of the Rambam Sfarim. Not only that, right? But Rabbeinu Yonah then goes to the Christian authorities and says, this is heresy, right? And on the grounds of, it's heretical to Christian faith, right? So he goes to the leading Christian authorities in northern Spain, in Paris, and he gets them to get caught up in all of this, and that's what resulted in 1233 of the burning of the Rambam Sfarim in the square in Paris. The same square, by the way, which 10 years later sees the burning of the manuscripts of the Talmud itself. So something that Rabbeinu Yonah, on the end of his life, just was dejected about. He was extremely regretful over his involvement in this burning of the Rambam Sfarim. There are sources that indicate that the Rabbeinu Yonah actually saw this as providence, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was punishing the Jewish people of France for their involvement in the burning of the Rambam Sfarim and their rejection of the Rambam. Be that as it may. So what happens in the 1230s, Rabbeinu Yonah goes up north and gets everybody to sign on this ban. There's a huge pro Rambam camp in Provence. Huge. Right? Among rabbinic elites as well. And what do? They're livid, right, about what Rav Shlomo ben Avram of Montpellier is doing. So they send the Radak, Rav David Kimchi, right? What did the Radak write that we all know about? What commentary on Tanakh? Right? We all, Radak is a household name. Radak was in his 70s at the time, an old, old man. And they send him to travel through the Pyrenees Mountains, right? The natural border between France and Spain is a mountain range known as the Pyrenees Mountains. So he undertook this journey, insanely, in his 70s, to go garner support for a ban on Rav Shlomo of Montpellier. Right, Rav Shlomo ben Aaron of Montpellier, you know, he's going to sue you, or we're going to counter sue you. Right, so the Radak, they then have a ban on Rav Shlomo of Montpellier, basically pitting one camp of the pro Rambam camp against the anti Rambam camp, and they send the Radak down to Spain. Problem is that Spain by that point is hugely influenced by the Christian authority, and the Radak never really gets the support that he wants. He gets some support, but he doesn't. But he's shocked that the Rambam's own kinsmen, what he thought were going to be the Rambam's own kinsmen, the Jews of Spain, were not supportive of the anti-ban, which is the new ban on the Chachmei Provence. And what's left is this unresolved, terrible situation. So the Ramban, who is the Ramban comes along, who, again, is a little biography over here, he then features into all of this. The Ramban comes along, and he sees these two leading groups of rabbinic scholars that are at each other's throats, and he wants to make peace. And if you know anything about the Ramban, you know that some of the chief works of his life were spent trying to reconcile differences between different rabbinic authorities. The Ramban did this on several occasions in a lot of different ways. You read through his Parash al Torah, he's doing this a lot. So the Ramban writes a letter to the rabbinic authorities of France, of northern France, the ones that endorsed the ban, basically coming to the Rambam's defense, saying, "Let me, you know, I think that you might have misread things. I think that you might have been misled about what the Rambam's intentions were. It's not really worth the ire that you're doling out for this." And he writes this letter in 1238, and this actually ends up being, and we have the letter in full in Chavel's edition of the Kitvei HaRamban. I put a section of it over here, so I encourage you all to read it. But basically, that's what ends up ending the controversy of the 1230s. So even after we've gone through this terrible event, and that doesn't mean that the Rambam is now, you know, endeared to French Jewry, but the bans and everybody being at each other's throats, but the Ramban using his full authority in order to come to the defense of the Rambam, essentially works, and things end up being dormant for another 50, 60 years until the Maimonidean controversy flares up again, but that we'll save for another time. That will be stage three of the Maimonidean controversy. Thank you, everybody.
The burning of the